Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kilton's The Day the Cowboys Quit. Performed by Terrence Acil Ford, Bradley Smith, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Michael Glenn, Alyssa Wilmoth, Ken Jackson, Joe Brack, Thomas Keegan, Scott McCormick, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Danny Gavigan, Patrick Bussink, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Nanette Savard, James Lewis, Christopher Sheeran, Drew Kopus, Michael John Casey, Kimberly Gilbert, and Mort Shelby. In later years, people often asked Hugh Hitchcock about the Canadian River Cowboy strike of 1883. If they were strangers, he looked them over carefully before he answered, and sometimes he didn't answer at all. He figured there was no way of explaining it to anyone who didn't understand the nature of the old-time cowboy. It irritated him like a prickly pear thorn embedded under his hide that some people seem to think cowboys spent their time loping around aimlessly on horseback and firing their pistols. Many of the men he had known in the Texas Panhandle never owned a pistol, and probably half the cowboys between the Canadian and the Pecos could not have shot themselves in the foot if they had tried. What they did most in those days was work. From before they could see in the morning until they could no longer see in the evening. Those days, a man proved himself with horsemanship. A rider a cut above average was looked up to, even by the sourest wagon cook. If a man's saddle didn't have a shine to it, they knew nothing good would come of him. Next to his way with a horse, a cowboy was proudest of his independence. He worked for other men, but they owned nothing of him except his time. He was a free soul. He could ride from the Rio Grande to the Powder River and seldom see a fence. He could start that ride with $5 in his pocket and have three left when he finished, if that was the way he wanted to travel. Money did not rule him. The Canadian River region of Texas then was less than 10 years settled. The sandy-bottomed river cutting a deep, rough gash across the heart of that uplifted tableland known to the Spanish as Llano Estacado, the Staked Plains. It was a grand plateau, larger than some eastern states, a vast, treeless ocean of grass, often flat to the eye, but gently rolling when a man tested it in a wagon, finding himself alternately easing downward or putting forth extra effort to climb. A decade before, this prairie had teemed with grazing buffalo, fleet white-rumped antelope, and the roving packs of gray wolves which lived among them, pulling down the halt and the lame. Across this unmapped sunny land had roamed the Comanche and the Kiowa, brothers to the wolf. They had known its hidden watering places, its changing seasons, its hunger, its bounty, its angry storms, and its quiet peace. Now the buffalo were gone, and with them the Indian. White men's cattle by the hundreds of thousands had plodded and bawled up the long trails from South Texas and down through Raton Pass from Colorado, spreading out over these seemingly infinite miles of open grasslands, finding water in occasional creeks and streams fringed with cottonwood and hackberry and black walnut, almost the only timber from the eastern caprock to the New Mexico breaks. Out in open country, wood was so rare that men gathered dry buffalo and cow chips for fuel wherever they found them, hoarding them in sagging cowhides lashed loosely beneath their wagon boxes. Now most of the plains grass was claimed by right of occupancy, and already the more observant cowboys could see that it grew less tall. Dust stirred easier now, a sign of overgrazing, Because these great herds of long-horned cattle did not migrate with the rains and the changing seasons as had their wild and shaggy predecessors. Already, men, in their eagerness for gain, foreshadowed their own defeat by demanding more from the land than it could produce. And those in a position to hire demanded more of other men. Hugh Hitchcock always said cowboy independence triggered the cowboy strike. There came a time that some men decided independence was too costly when the wrong people had it, so they tried to mold others to a pattern of their own cutting. And when you crowd a man too far, he may do something in self-defense that is not sensible either. Old cowboys in later years argued no end over the causes of the strike and the starting of it. For each, it began in a different place and a different way. To Hugh Hitchcock, looking back, it started the day Rascal McGinty and the Figure Four rep went to their guns over ownership of a roan cow. He always remembered the kind of day it was. The sun bright over the gentle roll of the open plains, the sky blue as a pretty woman's eyes, the brown winter grass starting to show tinges of springtime green, the first prairie flowers bursting scarlet and yellow and white. He remembered Rascal McGinty and that red face of his and red hair and a temper to match them both. Rascal was riding Sweetheart, an ill-named Mustang Bay. Hitch always recalled that Dayton Brumley was riding a Figure Four sorrel called Blaze for the crooked streak that ran from Forelock down to a Snip Nose. She wasn't much of a cow. She had seen too many hard winters, and the scrubby calf punching its long nose futilely at her near-dry udder showed she had been less than choosy in the bull she associated with. But to a syndicate outfit like the Figure Four, its bookkeepers dreading each encounter with the Kansas City Board of Directors, every calf branded meant dollars of capital gain on the ledger. To a wage-working cowboy like Rascal McGinty, or his brother, Law, trying to build a shirt-tail herd for themselves, even a crippled cow or a blind one was of value so long as she could yet conceive and deliver. When Dayton Brumley rode into the stray herd and called the cow's brand a Figure Four, Rascal stood straight up in his stirrups.
The hell you say? That cow's an LR, sure as ever was.
Hugh Hitchcock heard, and the voice was a warning flag. Hitch was wagon boss on the W's River Division, that part of the ranch which lay nearest the Canadian, and the McGinty brothers worked under him. He knew Rascal's emotions lay always near the surface. A cowboy came spurring.
Hitch, you better get over yonder. There's apt to be trouble.
Hitch rode over to the two men.
Go slow, Rascal.
A young W rider named Joe Sands had a rope around the calf's neck and was waiting for Hitchcock's judgment before he dragged the animal out to the men afoot by the branding fire.
The Figure Fours need to buy old Dayton a set of eyeglasses, Hitch. I know that old cow. I can recollect the color of every calf she's given to me in law.
Let's have a look at her.
Hitch leaned from the saddle for a close look at the brand.
Somebody done a bad job with the iron. The way it's haired over, she could be either one or neither one. I've been telling you, Rascal, your LR brand is too much like the Figure Four.
Tell them. Me and law, we had our brand first. Let the Figure Four change theirs.
Dayton Brumley, crowding 40, was an employee too far removed from policymaking to comment.
I call her a Figure Four.
Another cowboy trotted up on a nervous-eyed dun. It was Law McGinty, 4 or 5 years younger than his brother Rascal.
Yeah. What is it, Rascal? That rich damn Yankee outfit trying to steal our cow?
Boy,
don't bust your cinch, Button. Hitch is fixing to set things straight.
We'll stretch her and take a good look.
Hitch dropped his loop over her horns and took up the slack, then motioned for Law to catch her hind feet.
Yeah.
They laid her down helpless on the ground. Hitch walked over, kneeled down, and carefully ran his fingers over the brand, trying to feel through the hair any scar that didn't show to the eye. This was complicated by the fact that he was missing the tip of one finger, pinched off between a rope and a saddle horn a long time ago. A missing finger or a gimpy leg were marks of a working cowboy. He shook his head.
Still can't tell.
I said I know that old cow, and I'll prove it.
Rascal brought out a pair of tweezers and began plucking hair. Deaton Brumley hunched over Rascal, critically watching his work with the tweezers. If Deaton saved them 100 such cows, the figure four would not raise his wages a dollar. But he had an old-time cowboy loyalty. When you worked for a ranch and accepted its pay, you stood up for it to the turn of the final card. If you couldn't be loyal to an outfit, you called for your time and rode away. Rascal's tweezers caused a definite outline to begin showing through the hair.
Like I told you, Hitch, she's coming up in L.R. plain as the tobacco in old Dayton's mustache.
Because he's using the tweezers on it.
Settle down, boys. One cow ain't worth a fight.
Not to an outfit's got 50,000 like her. But to a little man grinding himself to the bone for $30 a month, she's worth a fight. You ought to know.
Hitch decided Rascal had picked long enough. He ran his fingers over the brand and was 75% sure.
Dayton, it looks like an LR to me.
It looked like a figure four till he took the tweezers to it. If I'd had the tweezers, it'd still be a figure four.
You calling me a cheat?
Brumley didn't say so out loud, but the answer lay plain in his eyes. Rascal took a step toward him, and Law swung a leg over the cantle.
Law, you stay up there and keep that rope tight. Rascal, you and Dayton go cool off in opposite directions. We got work to do here.
Which way you calling that calf?
Hitch saw a heavyish man riding around the herd toward them, and he felt relief.
Yonder comes Charlie. We'll have him confirm it, and then we'll hear no more about this cow.
Solemn-faced, Charlie Wade climbed down from the saddle.
I come in after riding 20 miles from the Eastern Division and find somebody pawing sand. What the hell's the matter here?
No trouble, Charlie. Just been a little question come up over the brand on this cow.
I'd call her an LR.
Rascal, I'll see that the calf is branded for you. I want you to go to the wagon and find out how much Trump lacks having dinner ready.
It was a useless errand, for Trump Tatum always had dinner ready at straight-up noon, and he'd be cussing if he didn't see cowboys on the way. But Rascal took the order without question. He rode off, his back straight, his hat cocked a little to one side, a picture of justice triumphant.
Charlie, I'll have to talk to the company about this.
You do that.
It ain't the cow, Charlie. It's the principal.
Brumley rode into the herd to seek out figure four cattle that had strayed into W country.
One damned cow. The figure fours will lose more than that between the barn and the hayloft.
He could get himself killed someday. You reckon they know it?
He's just a name on the payroll.
Hitch nodded at the cowboy who still held the calf on the far end of the rope.
Tell him to put an LR on him, Joe.
Law McGinty gave slack to the rope, and the cow shook her heels loose. Charlie paid no attention to the cow. He still watched Brumley.
He'll cool off. Soul rascal.
Ain't nothing like it was, Hitch. This was a cowman's country once. A cowman gave his word, and another cowman took it. Now it's a different breed. Syndicates, Yankee bankers, English money, and all that. Ain't enough anymore just to know the cow.
Hitch had accompanied Charlie last year on a trip to Kansas City to try to float a loan. Charlie had been in a cold sweat the whole time, going from bank to bank with a new white hat crushed awkwardly in his big hands, trying to talk the language of men he couldn't understand, men measuring him for what he owned and not for what he knew or what he was. Charlie had finally obtained an expansion loan, smaller than he wanted, and he had to sign over everything but his own blood to get it. Charlie Wade had always been strict about liquor. He didn't allow the cowboys to drink on the place, but he stayed drunk all the way home, down in whiskey as a purgative to cleanse away the stain of humiliation. At the time, he made his feelings clear.
I feel like a crippled horse penned up amongst a pack of gray lobo wolves. I was fishing in deep waters against that crew.
Hitch felt that Charlie's time in Kansas City had scarred him deeper than his encounter with the Yankee Saber. To a cowboy like Charlie Wade, the world of finance was the Tower of Babel. But he was in it up to the gray tips of his mustache and determined to ride it out. To remain a cowman of major proportions these days, that's what a man had to be, determined. The roan cow was the only one that day whose ownership caused any dispute. Most cows in the gather clearly showed the W brand. A few carried small owner brands like the Two Diamonds of Hugh Hitchcock or the LR of Rascal and Law McGinty. Some carried the Syndicate's Figure Four. When one appeared questionable, Dayton Brumley took a careful look for the benefit of the company he worked for, but earmarks or a quick clipping of the hair were enough to establish ownership. Hitch made it a main order of business to be sure the McGinty brothers and Brumley were kept far apart. He hoped by dark they'd be too tired to do anything more about their grudge. Late in the afternoon, Law McGinty asked Hitch if it would be all right for him to drop out and ride over to the breaks to see his wife.
I'd be much obliged, Hitch. I'll be back by daylight. Her being in a family way and all, I like to look in on her pretty regular.
I wish you'd take Rascal with you.
If you was married, Hitch, you'd know not to ask a man a thing like that.
Law rode away without supper. Kate McGinty would cook him a better meal than he would get at the chuck wagon. Trump Tatum's chin was fuzzy, but he had more hair on one joint of his index finger than on all of his head. He'd been Charlie Wade's wagon cook 15 years or so. Trump had his rules, and the cowboys either knew them or learned them damn quick. A minor infraction could spark sarcasm bitter as gyp water, and a major breach could send Trump into a glorious case of the rings that would spoil coffee for 3 or 4 days. At the same time, he had a protective feeling for the cowboys whose digestion he was slowly ruining. He seemed to sense the tension resulting over the roan cow, and a benevolent gleam shone in his wrinkle-edged eyes like the welcome glow of a lantern to a man lost at night on the open prairie.
Boys, I figured this evening would be a good time to use up that dried fruit Miss Wade brung to the wagon. I fixed you all a nice cobbler for supper. Rascal, I know how partial you are to cobbler.
If you're trying to sweet do me into dragging you up some firewood...
You know I never had no such notion.
The hell you didn't?
Dayton Brumley still brooded over the roan cow. As rep for the Figure Four, he enjoyed the privileges, such as they were, of the regular W cowboys, as did reps for the other brands. But tonight he kept to himself, taking a long time unsaddling his horse. He waited until the W men and the other company reps had all filled their plates before he went to the chuck box and got one for himself. Spooning into it quietly, he strode out to his bedroll and squatted down alone. Trump Tatum leaned his thin old frame against the wagon wheel, his uneasy gaze touching Brumley first, then Rascal. It wasn't customary for a wagon cook to carry food to anybody. A man came to the fire and helped himself, or by God did without. But when the rest of the men were through, Trump took the Dutch oven to Brumley.
I wouldn't want it said that the W wagon didn't feed its neighbors.
The W's is all right. It's just one or two of them that works for it who bothers me some.
Supper done, Trump began rattling the tin plates and cups in his wash tub, then dropping them into a second tub of scalding hot water. A kid horse jingler, low man of the outfit, fished them out gingerly with his fingers and dried them to put them back into the chuck box. Charlie Wade walked away from the wagon out where the night horses had been staked. He stood a long time staring into the starlight, his hand reaching up and rubbing his bad left arm. Hitch finished his coffee and joined him.
Arm hurting you tonight, Charlie?
Arm hurts me every night. Nothing new about that.
You got something else on your mind, then?
There's always enough worries to go around. That damned roan cow is apt to bring trouble to camp even yet. Been better if she'd died last winter. Then I know enough to break 2 Kansas City banks. And finally, there's ugly talk going around some of the wagons.
Talk?
Discontent. I can't find out enough to get to the guts of it. Heard any talk around this wagon hitch?
Only about horses and cattle. And women.
I hope it stays that way.
For an hour or two before they crawled into their blankets, the cowboys usually sat near the campfire, feeding it just enough to keep it from dying. They spun old tales and half-truths about the so-called better days. Charlie Wade was once one of the best storytellers of the group, and it delighted him to entertain the boys. He began telling fondly about a bay horse he once had traded from a Mexican and had ridden off to war, only to lose him in battle.
Many's a good horse I've ridden before and after, but never one I thought more of than that bay. When the war was over, I went looking for the Mexican, thinking he might have some more horses of the same blood. But he got himself killed in some war down in Mexico, so I reckon the blood was scattered and lost. They sure had good horses in them days, the likes we'll never see again.
Rascal McGinty fidgeted to talk, and the moment Charlie finished, Rascal grabbed his chance. He told about a horse he had gotten once from a Mexican. Stolen. No, stolen wasn't the word for it. Because down in that Rio Grande country in those days, you didn't steal when you took from a Mexican. You only exacted vengeance for the Alamo and other atrocities. So, for that matter, did the Mexican when he stole from you. Thieving took on the aura of patriotism. The way Rascal told it, that horse could do almost anything except count cattle. Upshot of the story was that the Mexican was a low-down scoundrel who came one night in the dark of the moon and stole the horse back.
We'd have hung that thief if we could have caught him. But the horse was so fast that nothing we had could get close enough to give us the smell of his dust.
At the sound, Trump Tatum lifted the lantern from the chuck box lid onto the top, so it might better serve as a guide. Hitch pushed up to his feet and dropped extra wood on the fire so it would blaze up. The cowboys had to move away from its heat. He frowned at Rascal, then at Dayton Brumley. The general manager and major stockholder of the Figure Four was coming. Hitch could have done without him very well. He had no inclination to walk out and meet the man, but Charlie Wade arose stiffly and stepped forward to extend the hand of hospitality from one owner to another. Brumley went too, for this man was his boss. Prosper Selkirk was not by birth or training a range man, but he had been in cow country long enough that he knew better than to ride up into the wagon cook's domain and raise dust. He stopped at the edge of the firelight. A saddled horse was tied to the rear of the buckboard. Charlie Wade stuck out his hand.
You're traveling late, Prosper, but Trump's still got some supper left.
Selkirk jerked a thumb toward three sleek greyhounds tied in the back of the buckboard.
Take care of the hounds, Brumley. The dogs ran themselves down chasing lobos, and Doc caught us. Just making a visit to all the neighbors' wagons in the interest of the Figure Four.
If this had been some luckless cowboy stumbling in late, Trump Tatum would have chewed him up and spit him out. But he deferred to Selkirk.
Biscuits is cold, Mr. Selkirk, and the steak is apt to be a little greasy now.
I never count on much around these chuck wagons. I'll survive until I get home to something better.
Tatum had fetched a plate and utensils out of wooden drawers for him, but now he left them sitting on the chuck box lid and jerked his thumb toward the wagon.
Yeah, there's cups in yonder.
I suppose the leftovers would be good enough for the dogs.
Tatum neither turned nor tried to answer. He stalked off toward his bedroll in angry silence. Selkirk was in his late 40s, basically an indoor man whose aptituded figures in a banking institution had earned him the confidence of men owning substantial fortunes and wanting more. Selkirk knew how to make money for them, and incidentally for himself as well. The Figure Four to him was a beef factory, little different from a shoe factory or a plant for the manufacture of farm implements. The Figure Four was basically a set of ledgers that must always show a comfortable figure in black at the bottom of every page. Under his direction, it usually did. The neighboring ranches were regarded as competitors for the beef buyer's dollar, and the cowboys were names on a payroll book that seemed always to show too much money paid out for the services rendered.
You know Hitch is a good man with cattle. He called that brand an LR, and so did I.
Charles, if you say she was an LR, I'll accept that as the word of one gentleman to another.
She belonged to Rascal and Law McGinney. They've been cowboying for me a long time. They're as honest as the day is long.
Selkirk moved to the fire and poured a cup of coffee.
Never seems civilized to take it without cream. Pity with all these cattle there never is any milk. Charles, that brings up a point I've wanted to talk to you about. That you let some of your men run cattle of their own.
Always have.
It's a bad practice. We don't allow it at the Figure Four.
So I've heard.
Have you ever thought what such a practice can lead to?
It leads to me being able to keep good men here when some outfits have to scratch to find men that know which end of the cow eats grass.
There are always men looking for jobs. We can hire all the cowhands we ever need at $25 a month and turn others away. We don't have to grant special favors.
There was a time I couldn't pay $25. I gave my men cattle.
An expedient of the time. When times change, a business enterprise should change with them. Has it ever occurred to you, Charles, how easy it would be for some of your men to brand your cattle with their own irons? And when one of them finds an unbranded maverick out on your range, how do you know he puts your brand on it and not his own? You can't watch them everywhere they go.
I hire men I can trust.
No man can be trusted if the stakes are high enough. I've heard rumors, Charles, even about your men.
If rumors was cattle, this whole country'd be overstocked and the grass grazed down to the roots.
Hitch had sat still as long as he could.
Charlie's right, Mr. Selkirk. Treat a man fair and you can trust him.
You have some cattle in a brand of your own, don't you, Hitchcock?
Charlie Wade has personally watched me brand most every cow I own.
I wasn't singling you out, Hitchcock. I was only pointing out that your position might prevent you being altogether the best judge of what I consider to be a bad practice. Charles, I've been in conference with some of the other major owners. Most of us agree it would be a healthy thing on this range if we made it a blanket order that no man employed for wages be allowed to own cattle.
By now, every cowboy was listening. Even Trump Tatum had come back from his bedroll, barefoot and in his underwear.
Some of these men stuck with me through cruel hard times, and they've been years building up a shirt-tail outfit of their own. What kind of a man would take that away from them?
I'm not suggesting you take anything away, Charles. Nobody advocates cheating any man out of his rightful due. We would all agree to buy such cattle at a fair market price and vent the brands to our own. Then, after a specified date, no man on a ranch payroll would be allowed to own cattle. That would take away the incentive for brand changing and maverick chasing and all these other evils that stand in the way of sound business practices on these ranches.
You do as you please on the Figure Fours. This here's the W's.
You're not alone on this range. You owe the rest of us something, too.
I don't know how you figure that. Was you there helping me when my herd was dying of the Texas fever? No, you wasn't. Was you there when the Indians kept coming back off the reservations and cutting across the country, taking cattle, shooting at whoever got in their way? No, you wasn't. But there's men here that was, like Hitch and the McGinneys and some of the others. I don't take nothing away from them, and they won't take nothing away from me.
Perhaps you're right. Perhaps no one in your employ would take cattle from you. But they might not be so scrupulous in respecting the property rights of the rest of us. How do you know, for instance, that they wouldn't take Figure Four cattle if the opportunity presented itself? And on a range as large as this one, there is always opportunity.
Dayton Brumley took his stick and began to sketch in the sand.
Like that cow this morning, Charlie. You and Hitch called her an LR, and maybe you was right. But can you say for sure she was always an LR?
Brumley drew a Figure Four brand in the sand. It was open-topped for easy healing.
Now look here. Now all a man has to do is add a little at the top and bottom, and he's got an LR.
Rascal McGinty came around the fire in a rush. Before Brumley could get to his feet, Rascal hit him. Hitch threw his arms around McGinty and wrenched him loose.
Rascal! Ain't no boot-licking Figure Four punch you're gonna call me a thief!
His eyes wide, Rascal ran for the chuck box.
I got a pistol in there!
Dayton Brumley scurried desperately for his bedroll and rammed his hand down into his canvas war bag. Hitch knew he kept a .45. Hitch ran for Rascal. As Rascal fished the cook's pistol out of the chuck box, Hitch grabbed his arm.
Rascal, let go of it.
He called me a thief!
I want that gun, Rascal, before somebody gets killed.
Glass shattered from the lantern atop the chuck box. Hitch wrenched the pistol from his hand. Turning quickly, he saw Dayton Brumley crouched by his bedroll, pistol ready.
Put it back, Brumley. There'll be no fight.
Seeing that Hitch had the other pistol, Brumley slowly let his own sag and finally placed it back in the canvas sack. He was on hands and knees.
Is it all over, Hitch?
The kid Jingler was cowering under the wagon.
It's over. You can get up. Dayton! You owe Rascal an apology.
Brumley was in no mood to apologize. Hitch thought it probable the man couldn't even speak. Selkirk spoke for him.
He apologizes. It wasn't meant the way your man took it. It was only meant to show what could happen.
And you, Prosper, you've seen what can happen, too. Better go slow in making implications against a man.
Brumley, it's best you leave this wagon tonight. Now, gather your things and go over to our east wagon. Send Estep to rep for us here.
The cowboys went quietly to their blankets, though nobody would sleep much. Rascal sat by himself on the wagon tongue, trembling in delayed reaction. Old Trump Tatum scratched himself through his long underwear.
Hitch, maybe we ought to go talk to him.
And say what?
Hell of a note is all I can say. I'm glad it's over with.
Prosper Selkirk stood beside Charlie Wade.
If this doesn't change your mind, Charles, I'll find something that will. You've got to be with us. We won't have you against us.
Good night, Prosper.
As the figure four manager moved toward his buckboard and the bedroll he carried there, Charlie Wade walked stiffly to Trump's chuck box. He reached deep into it and came out with a bottle Tatum kept for medicinal purposes. He walked around to the wagon tongue, nudged Rascal, and without saying anything, handed him the bottle. Rascal looked up at him, blinking in surprise. He uncorked the bottle and took a long, double swallow. Charlie retrieved the bottle and took a swig that finished it.
Go to bed now, Rascal. Go to bed before I haul off and kick your butt.
Hitch slept little. When Trump Tatum got up grumbling to start breakfast, Hitch got up too.
That thing last night could have turned out a whole lot worse. I keep wondering if there was something I ought to have done different.
Well, you done your job the way you seen it. You wasn't partial to no man. Don't fret over what you can't change. Take things as they come. Stay cheerful. That's what I always say.
By the time the water boiled, Rascal was up. He came silently to the fire, nodding at Trump and Hitch and glancing to see if the coffee was ready yet. His sleepy eyes showed he hadn't slept. Rascal furtively rubbed his right hand.
Hurt?
A little. You gave it a right smart of a wrench.
Had to.
I know. A man ought to have better control of himself. I might have killed Dayton Brumley if you hadn't stopped me.
Or he might have killed you.
We're a pair of damn fools, him and me. The hell of it is, I know I'd do the same thing again.
Well, he's gone.
But his boss ain't. Dayton only said out loud what Selkirk was thinking.
The cowboys began getting up from their sugans a little while later. Law McGinty rode in about the time the horse jingler brought the remuda for the men to catch their morning mounts. Law turned his horse loose among them and went to the wagon for a plate. He knew nothing of what had happened here last night, and Hitch had assumed somebody else told him. He was mostly concerned that Law was late getting his breakfast. The other cowboys were ready for their horses.
I'll be there, Hitch, before they get mounted.
How's Kate?
Kate? Oh, she's fine, getting along fine.
She oughtn't to stay there by herself much longer. You ought to send her someplace or get somebody to go stay with her.
Oh, it ain't that time yet. Kate'll do fine.
Prosper Selkirk was up and out of his bedroll, finally. The figure four manager was not given to such early hours. Selkirk's greyhounds had been tied to the buckboard wheels all night. Now he turned them loose to allow them to stray out of camp and attend to the pressures of nature. The thin-bodied dogs moved cautiously around the remuda, watchful of the hoofs. Most of the horses were unacquainted with dogs, but knew the wolf. They watched with ears pointed warily forward. The cowboys formed a circle around the horses in the thin light of approaching dawn, stationing themselves 20 feet apart and holding the ropes up between them to fashion an improvised corral. It would not have held any horse determined to get away, but the horses had been conditioned by training to respect the rope. It was as impenetrable to them as if it had been 10 feet high and of solid oak. It would be chaotic for so many cowboys to try to rope out their own horses. Custom had delegated this responsibility to 2 or 3 individuals, Hugh Hitchcock chief among them.
Catch me old Quanah.
Hitch, afoot inside the loosely held rope corral, shook out a large loop and spotted Rascal's horse about 3 deep in the milling bunch. He brought the loop up, gave it a backhand twist, and sent it sailing forward into the horses. It fell over the head and neck he had aimed for. The horse dropped its head, hoping to shake off the loop, but Hitch pulled up the slack. Once caught, Quanah came out of the remuda without resistance. He had learned through hard experience that it was useless to fight the rope. In a few minutes, horses were caught for every man. The rope corral fell, each man recoiling his own part of it. The remaining horses were turned back to the jingler to be loose-herded on grass until needed for another change when the morning's drive was finished and the day's gather brought into a single herd for working. The cowboys saddled their horses. Each moved hurriedly to be able to watch the show, for in every man's string were some green broncs, and on any given morning, one or more were sure to buck. It would not have been much of a show had it not been for Selkirk's greyhounds. One black horse crow-hopped, and that was all of it, until Selkirk realized his dogs were out of sight and became uneasy. They came in a run, too close to a wild-eyed bronc whose back was still humped under Joe Sands. The bronc bawled in fright and went straight up. When he came down from the third jump, he fell hard on his side. The horse struggled to its feet, but Joe Sands didn't get up. Hitch hit the ground and flipped his reins back for Law McGinty to catch. Sands tried to get up and couldn't.
My leg hits. I think that goddamn crowbait busted my leg.
As other cowboys gathered around, Hitch fell to the leg. Hitch found Charlie Wade standing there, his face grave.
It's sure as hell broke. Charlie, we better get him to town.
You take him, Hitch. We'll throw the stuff out of the hoodlum wagon. Prosper Selkirk has got his buckboard here. It'd be faster and easier, if it wouldn't be no imposition.
I had planned to... Well, I suppose it's the least I can do.
Hitch, me and Law got a light spring wagon over at our claim. Wouldn't be out of your way none to haul Joe by there. Then you could take our wagon and let Mr. Selkirk go on about his business.
Anything you want.
The cowboys put Selkirk's team to the buckboard and brought it around. They fetched Joe Sands' blankets and tarp, spreading them in the bed of the vehicle. Carefully, they lifted the man and covered him with a blanket Grump Tatum spared.
Where'll I put the dogs?
They got 4 legs.
Selkirk's saddle horse was still tied behind the wagon. Selkirk hadn't had time for breakfast. Hitch didn't give a damn. They rode in silence, Hitch devoting his attention to finding the smoothest ground and bouncing Sands as little as possible. He looked ahead, too, borrowing all the problems he might encounter down the road. Foremost would be to find a team that could pull the McGinty wagon. The McGintys had a pair of horses, but they might be grazing miles from the unfenced camp. Hitch made up his mind that if he didn't find them close by, he would keep Selkirk's. Selkirk could either go to town with him or stay at the McGinty camp.
Where is this place we're going?
The McGinty's claim. Law McGinty's wife lives there in a dugout.
A dugout? I can imagine what kind of woman she must be to tolerate that. Probably looks like some hard-used scullery maid.
She's a good woman, Mr. Selkirk. Pretty as a spring day.
You tell the doctor that whatever the cost is, I'll pay it. Since my dogs precipitated the incident, I think it's only proper.
And what if it turns out the leg won't heal straight? What if Joe winds up crippled? You gonna guarantee him a job the rest of his life?
I couldn't promise a thing like that.
Charlie Wade would. Trump Tatum would still be cowboying, likely, if one of Charlie's horses hadn't boogered him up. Charlie will see to it that Trump's never hungry the rest of his life.
No man can expect to be insulated from all risk. If I invest my entire fortune in a bad venture and lose it, nobody guarantees to take care of me the rest of my life. When a man gets on one of those bad horses, he knows the risks. He implies his willingness to accept that risk when he agrees to the job.
He accepts the job because he's partial to Eaton.
The same reason I take a risk and invest capital.
There's a difference between a man's limbs and his money.
Not basically. Your cowboy offers his skills in the marketplace. He sells the service of his hands, his arms, his legs. That is his equivalent of capital. I sell my capital in the service of my brain. We all sell something. We all risk whatever we sell. We are all at the mercy of chance.
Looks to me like you got more chance, though, than Joe has.
They dropped into the rough country that broke away to the river. Hitch pointed.
Yonder's the place.
Selkirk had to look hard before he was able to find the dugout, set into a hillside and almost hidden unless a person knew what to look for. The earthen roof and the sod front made it blend into the ground from which it came. The pole corrals were easier to see, cut from the cedar and hackberry, another small timber native to these breaks and the river bottom. To his relief, Hitch saw a couple of horses grazing down the draw, the McGinty team. A woman stood by the well, drawing up a bucket of water on the windlass. Her plain gray dress fluttered in the breeze as she heard the buckboard and turned to look, raising her hand to shade her eyes.
I thought you told me she was pretty.
She is.
Well, I suppose it depends on what one is accustomed to. I never could reconcile myself to these raw-boned, sunburned country women down here, living in a hovel like that.
A hovel? The house you live in don't matter so much. It's your feelings that count. Kate, now, she thinks that cowboy hung the moon, fixing to bear him a child pretty soon. She'd come from a farming family that scratched the hard earth for every bite they ate and every stitch of clothes they wore. You wouldn't call this a hovel.
When you burrow into the hillside like a badger, I'd call that a hovel.
Kate McGinty stepped away from the well, her hands still over her eyes. She was by nature a slender woman, though anyone with eyes to see would know she was carrying. Hitch saw apprehension in her face.
No, it ain't law.
Joe Sands, what happened to him?
I need the borrow of your wagon, Kate.
Absolutely, the horses are in the draw. Anything I can do for him, Hitch?
Joe's pained considerable. If Law's got a bottle stashed someplace...
In the house.
Kate hurried down the hewn log steps to floor level of the dugout.
She calls that a house?
You judge a person by his heart, not by his house. Kate has a heart as big as a door.
She hasn't even got a door.
Hitch pulled the Selkirk buckboard up beside the spring wagon that belonged to the McGintys. The two men carefully got their arms beneath the blankets and lifted Joe Sands from one vehicle across to the other.
I'll borrow your horse and go fetch that team. You can wait here or in the dugout. Maybe Kate has got some coffee.
I'll go fetch the team. She's a friend of yours. You visit with her.
As Selkirk swung into the saddle, Kate came out with a whiskey bottle.
Bourbon?
Oh, land sakes, I wouldn't know one kind from the other.
No matter. Anything will help.
Joe accepted the whiskey almost desperately.
Oh, thanks, Miss Kate. Thanks.
You're welcome. It helps my conscience anyway.
How's that?
Well, for a minute there, I was glad it was Joe instead of Law. I'm ashamed of the thought.
We're even. I wish it was Law instead of me.
You're looking fine, Kate. Real fine.
Thank you, Hitch. In all my life, I've never felt this good.
Kate touched a hand to her stomach.
It's, moving now. It's alive. I don't reckon a man would understand.
Well, it suits you. I was telling Law he ought to get somebody to stay with you, or maybe you ought to go to your mother. Is she still in town?
Oh, well, she washes for people and does cooking for the hotel when they need it. I got no business in town, Hitch. This is my home.
Well, you'll be needing help.
I'll have it when the time comes. There's a few other women up and down the river. There'll be somebody come. I sure wish Law could come home once in a while, though.
You haven't seen him?
Not in maybe 3 weeks. He's all right, isn't he?
Oh, he's fine. He's real fine, Kate. Kate, you and Law are getting along all right, aren't you?
Sure, Hitch. Why wouldn't we?
Well, no reason. He's a good boy, that Law. I'll give him a couple of days off soon and make sure he gets home.
Thanks, Hitch. You're a friend. Law says after the baby's big enough, we'll expand the house, build another room. Says it won't be much longer till we'll have enough cattle so he can quit working for the other man. He can come home and stay here with me. We'll live like rich folks in town do. That'll sure be fine, won't it?
It'll be real fine.
Hitch turned to look for Selkirk and the team. He could see them coming up out of the draw. But his mind was on Law McGinty. Where had Law gone last night? Selkirk helped put the team to the McGinty wagon.
I meant what I said, Hitchcock.
About what?
About paying this man's doctor's bills. I'm not as cold and conscienceless as you think.
I never said nothing against you, Mr. Selkirk.
You don't like me, though.
I just don't understand you, is all.
I've watched you, Hitchcock. You're sure of yourself. You have an easy way of leading men. I think I understand you better than you understand me. If you ever get tired of working for Charles Wade, come to see me. It would be strictly business. You don't have to like a man to do business with him.
I'll let you know how things go with Joe Sands.
Hitch flipped the reins and the fresh team high-stepped out of the yard.
Hey, Hitch.
Hurting you bad, Joe?
It ain't that. I was thinking, I heard what Kate said about not seeing Law. You reckon he's cheating on that girl?
I wouldn't know, Joe.
I'll stomp on him is what I'll do.
It'll be a long time before you stomp anybody.
By the time he had helped the doctor set Joe's leg, all the black coffee Hitch had downed was turning over and trying to come up. The doctor assured him that the leg would heal properly, for cowboys were a tough lot. But Hitch knew from experience that cowboys were not usually as tough as they looked to a man in town. They were flesh, blood, and bone like everybody else, and subject to a great deal more breakage than most.
You don't reckon this'll leave him crippled?
If whiskey'll cure him, he's a cinch.
Well, Joe don't normally drink this away. Charlie don't allow it at the ranch. I bet Joe ain't been drunk 3 times in his whole life.
You need to leave him here in town where I can look in on him.
Yeah, I figured on that. I'll go hunt him a place to stay.
He walked from the small frame house, grateful to be outside. He looked up and down the dusty street, past flat-topped adobes and picket shacks and square-fronted clapboard houses like the doctor's. A dry smile came as he mused that these were the people Kate McGinty considered rich. Hitch had to find Joe Sands a bed. But even more pressing for the moment was his own need for a drink to blunt the ordeal of setting Joe's leg. He stopped before a brown adobe structure of questionable architecture, whose vertical sign over the front door said, Cowboy Bar. Fant Gossett made sure his place lived up to its name. He catered to the cowboys and small shirt-tail ranchers who scratched for a living up and down the river.
How do, Hitch? Come in this house. How's everything out at the W's? How's that cranky old Charlie Wade?
Well, he's...
Seen you hauling somebody to town in a wagon and got a man hurt?
Hitch told him about Joe Sands. Gossett's brow creased in studied concern.
I got to find Joe a place to lay up. I was wondering if you got a spare room with a cot in it, or know where there's one to be had. And I'd need somebody to fetch Joe his meals. Prosper Selkirk's paying for it.
Well, Selkirk? You mean that tight-fisted dude's going to turn loose of little Kansas City money in this town? Just so happens I got a little house I've been renting out, and right now there ain't no girl, no renter in it. It'd be a Jim Dandy place for Joe. My My little old wife would be plumb tickled to fix extra at mealtime for a stove-up cowboy.
Now, just because Selkirk's paying for it don't mean I'd want it costing more than was fair.
That would be the farthest thing from my mind. I wouldn't ask for no more than was right. $1 a day, well, no, better say $1.50 when you figure how extravagant my wife gets with her cooking, if it's for sick folks. She's got a heart as big as her rump, and that's considerable. I bet I could find a girl who'd be glad to look in on that cowboy and be sure he don't die from lonesome.
Remember, Fant, he's got a broken leg.
Happy spirit helps heal the body.
Selkirk might frown on paying for the extras.
No charge, just a bonus throwed in with the room and the chuck. It'd only be fitting that I get my hands on a little Selkirk money. You know, he's made it awful hard against the figure four cowboys drinking any liquor at any place and any time. They come to town damn seldom. He figures to starve this little old town to death is the way I see it.
Just then, a cowboy walked through the open door, slapping his dusty clothes with a hat. He had a stubble of whiskers and a ragged brown mustache grayed considerably by a coat of dust.
Right, Faint. Oh, damn, that stuff clunks when it hits the belly like a horseshoe dropped into a bucket. Ought to be against the law to sell whiskey that bad. More. How much?
50 cents. 2 bits a shot.
2 bits? Ain't enough to poison a man, you got to rob him, too. When did it go up?
It's always been 2 bits, Asher. You just forgot.
Then it's always been too damned high. Always some son of a bitch trying to squeeze a nickel out of a cowboy's sweat and blood.
You sure came in with a burr under your blanket? Horse step on your foot or something?
I quit the snake tracks. That's what I done. Up and quit. I hope lightning strikes the whole damn outfit and kills everything but the lobo, wolves, and rattlesnakes, and I hope they multiply. Hitch, you still nursemaiding that old tightwad Charlie Wade? Old Charlie giving y'all the law yet?
Hitch didn't know what he was talking about. Cottingham pulled a folded paper from his shirt pocket.
This here's what I mean. Read that if you want to see how low and mean an outfit can get. They tagged this on our bunkhouse door.
I've been hearing about these, but it's the first I've seen.
Hitch had recognized it. The Nine Bars had posted the same set of rules a while back. A Nine Bar rep had brought a copy to the W-Wagon, and the cowboys passed it around to snicker over. They burned it to keep Charlie from seeing it and getting ideas. The majority were common sense rules, long observed but never formally written. One for bad drinking, card playing, or gambling of any sort, and required proper decorum about camp. Another forbade the use of the rope on cattle except in actual need. Another forbade abuse of horses. A man couldn't make much quarrel against these. Many would object, though, to rules which forbade the use of a company horse on any private business and forbade the keeping of individually owned horses without the express permission of the manager, which, in effect, could set the cowboy afoot except when he was working, or forbade tramps and idlers more than one night stay in a camp, a sharp departure from traditional range hospitality, and a direct move to eliminate the unemployed chuckline riders who, if down on their luck, could pass the winter free by spending a few days as guests in one camp, a few days in another. One forbade employees owning cattle in their own brand less than 2 fences away from the ranch where they worked, which in the Panhandle's open range country effectively canceled out their right to own cattle anywhere.
Well, a little extreme, some of them. But if a man don't like the rules, he's free to go and work someplace else.
Pretty soon there won't be no place to go unless we stop these big outfits before they get any bigger.
What do you mean, stop them?
They're teaming up against us, Hitch. I'm saying it's time the cowboys done a little teaming up of their own.
Seems to me like the people that own a place have got the right to run it as they please.
Not if they're going to step on us. Not if we was to call a halt. Ever occur to you, Hitch, that if all the cowboys was to quit at the same time, them ranchers would go to their knees in a week? Their money wouldn't save them. Nothing would move if we didn't do their dirty work. We'd have them by the short hairs.
You're talking about a strike.
You're damn right. There's a bunch of them been talking about it.
I've heard of factory strikes and miner strikes, but I never heard of a cowboy strike.
Nobody ever heard of the United States either till George Washington and some of them boys decided to show the Englishmen which way the river forked. We're not tow-headed schoolboys to be treated like this. We're men, and white men at that. There's a sight more cowboys than there is owners, Hitch. We'd have them begging us.
Been any rain over on the snake tracks?
Asher's got a point, Hitch. Them big outfits are out to run this country and ruin this town. Now, you know as well as I do that they control the politics. Half the counties you see on the map ain't organized. Ranchers don't want them organized. And then that is, they're under the ranchers' thumbs. Owners make sure the cowboys vote their way, and there ain't enough dissident votes to swing an election against them. Now they've taken it in their heads they're gonna squeeze everybody off the range but themselves. They've been meeting with one another, figuring out how to divide it all up.
Some of them old boys have fought each other over grass and water till one hates the ground the other walks on. They wouldn't agree to what time it is.
You've been tending old Charlie's cows and ain't had time to see it, Hitch. They're trying to come up with one thing to fix it, so won't no working man be able to run any stock of his own.
You know, Selkirk tried to push that idea on Charlie. Charlie didn't bite.
He will when they show him where it touches his pocketbook. Another thing, they've been trying to buy out or push out all the little outfits they can, especially the Mexican sheepmen. There's Mexicans here with sheep when the Comanche still had this country. Me, I got no particular love for a Mexican, but his money spends as good as anybody's. Selkirk goes up and down the plazas with a sack full of money and shoves it at them Mexicans, and letting them know that if they don't take what he gives them and move, they'll get moved anyway. Soon as he gets their names or their X on the paper, he burns their house so they can't tarry. And a bunch of them already trailed their flocks back over into New Mexico. Thing like that hurts this town.
They got paid.
Paid ain't enough. Selkirk could offer me $50 for a bottle of cheap rotgut, and I wouldn't sell it to him if he didn't treat me right. There's little men that built this town, and without them it'll die. You think them big outfits give a tinker's damn for us? They can buy everything out of Dodge City or Kansas City or someplace that don't even need their money, and they can starve this town to death. They don't want no town here, because a town means families, and families means kids, and kids means schools, and that takes taxes. Ever see a big rancher didn't choke into a conniption fit over the thought of paying taxes?
Fellers, you talking crazy. There won't be no strike in this country.
Why not?
Well, it just ain't done, that's all.
It'll be done if they don't change their ways.
Fant, the liquor's good. You get that house ready. I'll have Joe brought over when the doctor says to.
Sure thing, Hitch. Hitch! It occurs to me that Asher here's out of a job and y'all at the W's are short-handed since Joe's busted his leg.
We're not short enough to hurt us.
Let the other men work a little harder so old Charlie won't be out no extra wages. Is that it?
Charlie Wade always treats a man fair.
I don't know as I'd want the job no way. How much they paying at the W's?
30 and found. That's as good as there is.
$30 a month? Hell of a lot for a poor man risking life and limb to make some rich man richer. Keep your job, Hitch. I don't want it.
I never offered. I wouldn't want you out there agitating the men.
Me? I never agitated nobody in my whole life.
Asher Cottingham had said he intended to go visit some friends at one of the Figure 4 wagons and would like to ride part way with Hitch. Hitch figured what he was after was a few days of free chuck at Selkirk's expense, but that was Selkirk's problem. Back in town, the cowboy had invited himself to tie his horse behind the wagon and climb up into the seat.
Look at this. All this land claimed by the Figure 4s. Ought to be a law against companies like that in the first place. A working man ought to be able to stand up face to face with the man he works for, like the old days. Trying to talk to a company is like fighting your way through a tangle of spider webs. You never can get to the heart of things, if it's even got a heart. I say, no man ought to be allowed to own more than he can personally take care of.
If that was the case, who would you work for?
I don't know, but there ought to be a law.
It was a time of grand relief to Hitch when they finally came to a fork in the trail and Asher Cottingham climbed down from the wagon.
Well, I reckon I'll have to let you make the rest of the trip by yourself.
I'll miss you.
As he came on to W Land, Hitch began pulling out of the trail to inspect every grazing bunch of cattle he saw. At length, Hitch came upon a group of cattle that kept pulling away, maintaining a respectable distance between themselves and the wagon. But they were not so far that he didn't find himself staring in disbelief.
Slick ears. I swear there's slick-eared calves in that bunch.
He tried to maneuver the wagon around the cattle, but they kept edging away from him. Finally, he had to unhitch one of the horses, get on it bareback, and kick it bare-heeled into a trot that took it around the cattle. Bringing him to a halt, he counted 12 cows and 14 calves.
Slick, all right. Ain't but two branded calves in the bunch.
Those two were W calves following W cows. The rest of the cows were figure fours, plus one snake track, and not one of their calves carried a brand.
Can't hardly see how we missed them in the roundup. We worked this strip like a fine-tooth comb.
But there they were. Hitch decided the figure four cows must have drifted over onto this part of the W in a bunch, perhaps pressed by the roundup crews on the figure four. In late afternoon, he reached the roundup ground. The branding crew was sweaty and dirty and moving with the slowness that indicated a day's work was nearly done. Recognizing his own team and wagon, Law McGinty rode out from his position on the perimeter of the herd.
So you got back?
Thought about taking your wagon by your place and leaving it, then decided you'd rather take it back yourself, give you a chance to see your wife. Law, has there been trouble between you and Kate?
Why?
You left here the other night saying you was going home. Yesterday she told me it had been a spell since you was there. Now, maybe it's none of my business, but I think you owe Kate better treatment.
Color rose in Law's face. He offered no explanation.
You take this wagon home tonight and act like a husband. Be back here by daylight.
All right, Hitch. Want me to start now?
I think that would be a dandy idea.
Law tied his horse behind the wagon so we'd have a way to return to camp. Hitch climbed down, carrying a new lantern he'd bought for Trump Tatum, and handed the lines to Law. Hitch walked to the chuck wagon and poured a cup of coffee. Charlie Wade rode in from the herd director.
How'd you leave Joe Sands?
He'll mend.
Didn't happen to run into any other hand to take his place a while.
I saw Asher Cottingham. I didn't hire him.
Good. His jaw works like a gate hinge. Anyway, last I heard, he was at the snake tracks.
He quit.
Hitch considered a moment, then decided to tell him about the snake track posting the new company rules. Charlie nodded gravely.
Not a bad set of rules, though, the most of them. They make sense.
You seen them, Charlie?
Weeks ago. The owner's been passing them around.
You wasn't thinking about posting them rules yourself, was you, Charlie?
What do you think of them?
The good ones are understood without you having to write them down on paper, making men look like boys that need to be told to wipe their noses. The bad ones...
Maybe times change.
You ain't changed, Charlie. Neither of these men. You don't need to post rules like that. These men won't let you down.
I had company today. Owner of the Nine Bars was by to see me. Said there's some ugly talk amongst cowboys around the country. You hear anything in town?
Just Asher Cottingham belly aching. Nothing I'd take stock in. I get the notion that some of the boys resent the new rules, but that's nothing to concern yourself about. It's outfits like the figure fours and the snake tracks and the nine bars that'll have the trouble, if any comes.
So it's true, then, about the strike talk?
Ain't been none of it around this wagon, and there won't be. I'll guarantee you that.
Can you, Hitch? Can anybody guarantee anything anymore?